Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen's special coverage of E3 2018. My name is Kirk Hamilton. I'm editor-at-large at Kotaku.com. For the rest of this week, you're going to be hearing a bunch of short interview episodes featuring Jason Schreier, my co-host, and our news editor, talking with a bunch of game developers on the floor at E3. So, without further ado, here's Jason.
I am here with Garrett Young, formerly longtime video game executive and developer, formerly, most recently, the GM of id Software, the makers of the latest Doom and many, many other games, a studio with a storied history. Hello, Garrett.
Hello, Jason.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Nice to see you. Nice to meet you in person. First time I met you in person.
Yes.
And what'd you think of the trailer, the Doom announced, the next Doom announced?
It looks rad. Trailer. I'm very curious about it. I mean, I know you're not going to talk about like things that are coming in the future, but as I said on a previous episode of the show, the name Doom Eternal makes me think this is going to be like a game as a service type of thing where it's just constantly updated and added. So that's my theory.
A lot of people using that. A lot of people using that kind of infinite kind of theme.
Yeah. Halo Infinite, Doom Eternal. Yeah. Yep, that's the trend.
It is a trend.
So yeah, I thought it was great. Obviously, you guys. So you came in. When did you start at id?
I started in 2013.
Okay.
So yeah, as you alluded to, I've been making games a long time. Mm-hmm. Shows how old I am. I started at Microsoft years ago. Cut my teeth there. Learned a lot about game development. Learned a lot about software development from like early on, and then worked with a team called Bizarre Creations. You remember Project Gotham Racing?
I do.
So that was an Xbox launch title.
Yep.
What we used to be able to call Xbox One launch title, now we have to call it OG.
Xbox
OG. But that was great, and working with those guys was great at Bizarre Creations.
Yeah,
and that really taught me a lot about how to make games, not making software, but making games.
Uh-huh.
And then
so you're working on the publishing side.
That was the publishing side.
And so what was your role when it came to that? Just like working.
I was a producer working with them over there very often.
Uh-huh.
Me and three other people, a woman named Kiki, a guy named Andrew, and a guy named Jay, mm-hmm. were over there during 9/11. That was a memorable time for us.
Yeah, wow.
That's when Xbox launched, right? Uh-huh. The original Xbox launched right after 9/11.
Wow.
So that was kind of a scary time. But it was a great time. Those developers were great. And we had success, and the company liked what we did and with that. And my management gave me an opportunity to do a brand new internal team at Microsoft. Hadn't been done before. We hadn't done a racing game internally before, internal to the company. So that became Forza Motorsport,
mm-hmm.
which is still alive and thriving. And a lot of my buddies are still on that team. Dan Gray and John Wendell.
They just announced Forza Horizon 4.
That's right. And
ongoing,
Playground.
Never ends.
And Playground is joining the fray now.
That's so interesting. Interesting stuff.
Joining Microsoft. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So that was early on in my career. I've worked at Activision mm-hmm. a period of time, worked at Disney for a period of time, various reasons to join those for fun opportunities.
Back when
there.
Disney was making console games.
Back when Disney was actually making games. Yeah. It was this funny, huge eruption, which was a big part of kind of I got swept up in that and brought in. Uh-huh. They wanted people who had games experience, right? And I was a big part of that. And, you know, they bought Warren Spector Studio in Austin. The Avalanche guys in Salt Lake City are great.
Uh-huh.
They're still thriving. They're with Warner Brothers now.
Yep.
Propaganda Studio in Vancouver. So that was really fun working with all those smart guys and learned a lot there. But just as quickly as it rose, it also... for various reasons, is no longer around anymore.
Uh-huh,
so,
uh-huh.
But a bunch of good guys there, and then that gave me an opportunity to join id in 2013. So almost.
So
5 years.
So you must have left around the time when Disney bought Lucas and decided.
Yeah,
hey, we're
they
not
they
games
bought
anymore.
They had bought Marvel.
Okay.
I can't remember the public number. Some $4 billion. A lot of money.
Yep.
And then bought Lucas. I want to say the next year. They'd been investing in a lot of things. We actually even on the game side bought a company called Playdom, because Facebook games were all the rage back then. There was Zynga. There was Playdom, and there was one thing that I think EA bought.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was a big investment in the Games Group. And then we bought a mobile studio for $70 million or something.
Uh-huh.
So we had been doing a lot of growth. And then Marvel wasn't just, you know, and Lucas wasn't just for games.
Obviously, it wasn't for games at all. They clearly didn't want anything to do with games.
Well, yeah, a year or two later, they unfortunately divested from all that. But I was there during that time.
Uh-huh. And then you moved to IT, and you came to IT during a really interesting time.
It was a bit of a risk. Of course, yeah. I know IT from the 90s and loved it and played Doom. And I was kind of playing other games when Quake came out, but Doom was one of these iconic games in my history.
Yeah, yeah.
And 95% of the people we interview, very similar. I'm in the industry because of Doom and because of IT software and everything. So awesome place to work. But it was... there was a lot of negativity online.
Yeah, well, let's set the scene a little bit. So at this point, I think it was 2000. It was like a couple years earlier that they had announced Doom 4.
We shipped Rage 1
in 2011.
And Rage 2 is now coming out.
Yeah,
but that was 2011.
Rage 1 was 2011.
Exactly.
And then so they know John Carmack, infamous co-founder of ID, had been talking about Doom 4 for a while and saying, like, this is in development, but we hadn't heard a word about it.
So
I think 2008 is when he first announced it.
It may have been. I don't know the exact timeline. The strategy at the time at ID, an independent company, and they set their own rules and guidelines and processes and policies. What they would typically do is announce stuff before they started working on it as a recruiting tool.
Yeah.
Right? You say we're working on Doom, and you get a lot of resumes the next time. A lot of people calling.
Sort of like Bethesda the other night saying, hey, Elder Scrolls 6,
that's
coming.
That might be a similarity there.
Yeah. And so.
Although I think BGS has a lot of people who are working on lots of different things.
Huge, three different studios.
So I don't know
if
they need to do a lot of recruiting.
So ID Software, so Doom 4 had been in development or very early development.
Yeah.
It was reported by us, actually, that they went through a couple of reboots over that time. So Doom was clearly going through some identity issues when you came on.
Yeah.
So what was that like joining the studio at that point?
It was a little scary. And specifically my mindset, my thought process before joining.
Yeah.
Because I'd read the same things, right?
Whether it was
your guys' articles or the other articles that were online and some negative, I don't know where the sources of it. It wasn't necessarily a press thing. There was some, I sensed there was some negativity from employees who either were there or had been there previously. And I don't know any of the sources. But it makes you worry, right? Mm-hmm. You're making a career change. And on a career change, I got a family and I'm moving. I lived here in LA at the time and thinking about uprooting my family and moving halfway across the country.
Yeah, to Dallas.
To something that, I mean, the ID brand was drawing me. And I knew that they would have talented developers, right? An amazing engine and everything else. And I played all their games in the past, including Rage, just a couple years earlier. But there was risk, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know these guys. I've never worked with these guys. I didn't actually know anybody in the studio.
Yeah.
I met everybody through the process of interviewing, the leadership team, and then when I joined.
So what made you ultimately decide that it was worth the risk?
You know, it's an excellent question. I looked at it as a risk worth taking. Because imagine, look, when I was 20 years ago, starting first day of my career, there's no way in heck that I could have even dreamed of working at ID.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh my gosh, that's amazing working with those guys. That's brilliant. Everything
dreamed
they've done in the past and how they took the games industry in a direction that had never been seen before and moved PC units. I mean, people were going to buy computers and getting internet connection just so they could play Doom, right?
Yep.
Taking down work networks, taking down school, all those kind of things.
By the way,
right?
If anyone wants to hear the full story of that, Masters of Doom is a fantastic book
story. The funny story about that is we have a saying, it's actually Tim Willett saying that Masters of Doom, and I do like the book, it's like the story of Van Halen if told by David Lee Roth.
Mm.
It was kind of the inside joke. But I read that book before I joined, and I wanted a little bit more, know a little bit more, understand a little bit more about the background and the history from someone that did a lot of research and talked to these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a good read.
Yeah.
What it ultimately came down to was me thinking and reading online and seeing that they're in a kind of a bit of a challenging spot and thinking, if I can help be a part of rebuilding ID, helping to untarnish, if that's the word, improve their brand and untarnish, I guess, that studio and help them make great games again. I just think that's a risk worth taking.
Yeah.
And something when you look back on your career that you can be really happy about.
I did that. Yeah.
And I was a part of doing it, right? Mm-hmm. Game development, it's a team sport. It's not an I, me, thing. I know only a few people like the Martys and the Hugos get like the press and mm-hmm. show off. And mm-hmm. Tim are the ones that are out there on stage. But all those guys are the first people to tell you it is a team game.
Yep.
We would never have had the success with Doom or, you know, what's going on with, you know, the Quake Champions, mm-hmm. what we're able to release mm-hmm. there and ongoing with Avalanche and with Rage 2 without the team at id and without the great people we have.
So what was your role going to be as a GM? What does a studio GM actually do?
So every studio is a little bit different, but in this case, my role was very much a people and process role.
Okay.
Help the team, and very Doom focused. We didn't have Quake Champions at that time.
Right.
We didn't have the okay to work on that. We didn't have anything Rage 2.
I remember it was reported by us that Rage 2 was in development and then it was canceled at that point.
That's a few
little
years
while
ago,
before.
I know that was online and
it was
kicked
all
off
like
the DLC, but something, whatever happens before my time. But
and the studio pivoted to be like, we're 100% on Doom now.
Going to focus on Doom. Yeah. That's what I heard also. Mm-hmm. But what is GM?
Yeah,
that's
so
your question.
Yeah, so,
we got off
so
tangent,
people but, process.
So yeah, people and process help the studio to and help the team to deliver on our commitments. Mm-hmm. It's a big thing that kind of all GMs work as far as responsibility and students. Uh-huh. And we're in a situation where there were some culture elements that we needed to work on. We built the team around a core bunch of guys, Marty and Duffy, and Hugo was a part of that, and a lot of the other guys. And I'm not going to go through all the names because we'd be here for about an hour.
So what kind of culture elements when you say that? I hear that a lot about studio culture.
It's a big word, and it means different things to different people. But mostly when I think about culture and trying to help to improve a culture in a game development team and in mm-hmm. a studio is... it's all about making the place a place where people want to come to work.
Okay.
And there's a lot of things that go into that. Whether it's, you know, oh, we're going to do a beer 30, you know, this Friday afternoon. Or it's, I kept hearing, this is one of the funnier things, I kept hearing people say, oh, yeah, walking in here, it feels like a dentist's office. Like, okay, well, I guess we'll paint the walls, right?
Yeah.
So we sorted that out. We got it ready together to kind of go like, which colors do you like on the walls?
Yeah.
And then the different conference rooms. And it's a silly, stupid thing, but it's the kind of thing where people come into the office and go, oh, wow, this is kind of a neat game.
It's
office,
not the type
right?
of thing you think about. It's not. Maybe a game is a little bit better because morale is improved by the walls being painted different colors.
It's a silly, stupid thing. But it is just one small element. But the bigger piece of making it a place, helping to make it a place where people wanted to come to work every day mm-hmm. is focusing on the people. Mm-hmm. Right? I came in, I asked a lot of questions. I got a lot of information, a lot of brain dumps and smart thinking about here are the challenges that we'd love your help with, Garrett, and that we'd like you to focus on, right? Whether from my boss or even from people on the team at id. And some people had said, you know, a year earlier, this isn't a place I would have recommended to anybody, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. So you have to ask a lot of questions and understand where the holes are. Sometimes those holes are in process, which is a part of culture. If I come in, you've got artists or programmer or designer coming into work and they don't know what they're supposed to work on on a given day, on Monday, or the next week, now it's a different thing that they need to work on. Mm-hmm. So some consistency and some process improvements. You really have to look hard at the people. Like mm-hmm. I said, it's a people and process role. And there were... for lack of a better word, you know, some bad apples we had to move on from. Mm-hmm, and that, mm-hmm. this is part of game development and really a part of any team. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's people that don't believe in the vision. We had what we kind of ended up calling we kind of evolved our performance review process. Mm-hmm. And we kind of thought about things in two ways, hard skills and soft skills. It's kind of the simple way to think about it.
Sure.
And it always had a great history of hiring people with amazing hard skills.
Yeah.
But
the Carmack
soft skills,
culture.
Yeah, a little bit.
Because Carmack
a little
is
bit.
The ultimate, like...
No,
skill,
you know, big brain guy. Yes, and I've never met the guy in person, but of course I know of his reputation. Uh-huh. He was gone before I joined in. But there were some people that didn't necessarily buy into the vision, mm-hmm. Didn't necessarily buy into the future, and so we just had to have hard conversations and you move on. And what happens when you start making management decisions like that?
Yeah.
Is everybody else it impacts the team in a positive way. Sometimes there's short-term pain, right? Oh, well, this person was really a really strong animator, really strong rendering engineer, mm-hmm, really strong mm-hmm. whatever, right? And you have to backfill. Or you have to promote from within. We had some people who we promoted into leadership roles, really strong. They really grow. They really blossomed. Mm-hmm. But they weren't in a lead role before for various reasons. But people that don't buy into the future and don't buy into the vision, you got to make some hard calls.
So when you came in, was there like, were you starting from scratch essentially in the game? Did you have a vision?
No. We Starting from scratch.
Because I know say it went through multiple reboots.
Yeah, there is.
They confirmed publicly that they went through.
Yeah, there were some different changes in direction and changes in leadership of the team. It's a natural part of game development when things aren't necessarily going the way that the leaders on the team want or the team itself wants or the publisher wants. So it's a natural thing. And there was a change in direction. And I came in right 6 months after the change in direction really happened, and we were at a point where we have a thing called a midwinter every year, mm-hmm. Where it's like an internal E3, which is really great. It's great for internal PR. I mean, we at ID, we got to see what the BGS guys were working on,
cool.
Some of the stuff that's just announced the other day.
Yeah.
We knew that stuff a year ago, right?
Very cool.
We got to see some concept art here with the vision and the narrative and all everything else. You see Evil Within guys, the Machine Games guys, of course, who we love. We're that's our closest brother in the brotherhood of studios under ZeniMax.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, I came in a few weeks before that, and we had a demo that was looking really good for that midwinter event, and we had some executive meetings and everything, and that was the eras. To your question about where was I, what was 2013, fall of 2013 in my period in ID's history.
So, yeah.
That was when
I believe, if I remember correctly, it was around March, April of 2013 that it was like total starting from scratch. Like, this is our new vision. This is where we are. This is where we're going to be.
Yeah, there was it might have been a little bit earlier. Basically, yeah. And that the position I came into was not a position that ever existed before.
It
was Carmack was the leader, but he was the technical
right.
visionary, CTO, and all this with the studio. There was a guy who did a lot of biz dev called his name's Todd Hollinshead.
Yeah,
and he's working with a guy named Brandon James at Nerve in Dallas right now. Good guy, he had kind of a CEO title.
Well, if you look at, if you read Masters of Doom, it started as this essentially frat house with like 10 guys in a house,
four guys.
Before that, and just like the professionalization of the video game industry, you can watch it happening with ID, and I imagine that they went through growing pains over the years, and as they went from that like all dude like eating pizza and diet and drinking Diet Coke as we stay up all night coding that sort of culture to like, whoa, we are a real proper company.
Yeah, you go from 10 people back then
it's
to 200 people.
Yeah.
Even before I was there, there was a period where they were up to something like 200 developers.
Yeah. So talk to me about the development of the game. So you come in, you guys are fixing the people, fixing the process.
Well, and when I started, we had the midwinter demo, right? Which was really successful, and Marty did a great job on that. Duffy did a great job on that, and everybody that contributed to that who was there.
So
at
what
the
did
time.
That look like? Would that look like the Doom that we saw, Shep?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely right. We had two maps. We basically were focusing on. For our presentations, like 2014 was also the time where we announced in at E3. I think I have my timeline right there. Mm-hmm. Timeline right. Might have been 2015.
2015, because that was the first 2015? Bethesda conference. Was 2015?
Oh, okay, 2015. So then 2015 was the E3. Oh, sorry about that.
It's okay.
2015 was the E3 announced, mm-hmm. and then the thing that's even more memorable to me. Was the showing off live gameplay at QuakeCon.
Yes.
And we didn't stream that
and
live.
And you didn't, that was so funny
was
because
awesome.
Nobody actually saw it.
Was it was awesome.
It's just people had to rely on impressions from the show.
2,000 people in the room.
Yeah.
And when it kicked off, it was amazing. And I couldn't tell if the shaking on the floor was like from the bass and the speakers or because everyone was so excited. Everyone was cheering.
Yeah.
And it's kind of home field advantage, right? This is QuakeCon, right?
Course.
We've been doing it for 20 years. These are the hardest of
hardcore
ID fans. I love them. My first QuakeCon was, I think, the year before. Remember. I had never gone over to QuakeCon before joining ID, and it's just an awesome experience. And that was something that's really, you can see videos online of people that are kind of like outtakes walking out of the event.
Mm-hmm.
We did a live playthrough, which is really rare, right? Nowadays everybody does, it's canned, it's
pre-recorded.
Even if it's gameplay, it's still recorded because of the risk.
Because you don't want to make mistakes on stage.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And we had a guy named Steven Serafin who was just an absolute stud, one of our programmers, but used to be a pro Halo player.
Yeah.
And so he did the playthrough and he was, sweating bullets. He was so nervous. Doing it, but we were all nervous, right? We're all nervous that the build's going to stand up, and it was a pretty stable build.
Yeah,
but he had to get all the timing right of all the combat because Doom, and everybody listening knows Doom, right? It's very action heavy. It's a very like push forward combat is a phrase that Marty coined and a great phrase that describes what the actual experience is minute to minute in that game and how Doom is unique and different. So, but to get that all right and to make it look good, right? It's not, you're not doing a playthrough like a speed run. Mm-hmm. You want to make it look good too for everybody who's watching.
What were some of the struggles that you guys went through after you joined and like you had to get this game out the door after all the false starts and what were some of the obstacles that you had to overcome?
I think if I was to to break it down, I guess the 4.5 years I was there, that wasn't all Doom time. Obviously, we shipped Doom 2 years ago, right? So if I was to break it down into three periods, I would think about it as the build the core period, build the core gameplay experience, this push forward combat. There's actually even an animatic online that anybody can see that the game we shipped is very true to that animatic that was done back in, I think, early 2013 before I joined.
Yeah.
By our animators, a guy named Sheen, who's a stud, and BK and Brett and June and all these, Alan, and all these other guys over there.
It's just like a dude running around.
It shows, it's not arted up. It's in a city. It looks like a little bit of Earth, but we didn't do Earth in that Doom, obviously. But it shows this push forward combat and glory kills, and just it shows the type of experience in a very, you know, you can see that it's some sort of prototype. It's not, there's no art. It's not
right,
a level,
right.
But you've got some of the demons and they're attacking in certain ways and they're moving around the space.
Uh-huh.
It's not a script. I mean, it's scripted because it is an animatic, but the gameplay experience, the flow of gameplay was very, very active, very, very movement.
That's
a lot
cool.
of movement
it's
for the players.
It's useful to have that sort of like blueprint that for
vision.
Like, oh, look
it.
At that. And that's what we want to do.
Yeah. I heard a saying somewhere that I love and I keep repeating with everybody I talk to that a prototype is worth 1,000 meetings. It's probably worth 1,000 pages of design documents too.
That's great.
Because people get it, right?
Yeah.
People are like, oh, this is
you
what we want to build.
And, like, yeah.
And if there was reboots in the past and maybe that vision and the direction was a little bit different there, I don't know those. I did see some videos of some of them years ago. But it was a great
I heard divining about the Call of Duty stuff. Call of Doom.
Oh, Call of Doom. I read
it.
About that stuff. You know, that's people coined that phrase outside the studio.
Yeah.
That was not, I don't even know what the vision was. That was before my time.
Uh-huh.
But the Doom, and again, when I started there, I got the sense, and I even got to play during the interview process, got to play an early build, which usually that doesn't happen. I was really thankful and grateful that they let me. But I remember actually somebody else was grabbing with the controller and walking into a space. And this was a space that was arted up. It wasn't the animatic. And I remember thinking, okay, yeah, this looks really beautiful. Looks great. 60 hertz, of course, even then. It was running on PC, you know, big card. And but the guy, whoever it was, turned the corner and walked into a space, and I was like, holy crap, that's E1 M1. It had a vibe. Now it's all, you know, 2017 graphics, or you know, whatever it was, 2013 graphics.
Yeah.
But it had this sense of space that was, I know that. Like, it's you have that feeling in your head, like, oh, I've been here before, but obviously I'm at id, and I look at this and saying, holy crap, you guys are doing a great job. You know, this very evocative of something that I'd played 20 years ago, right? And so that was really great. And that continued on through the entire life of the project. Not so much that we recreated Doom 1 levels, right? I mean, we did have the things you could find that were the classic maps, you know, sections of the classic maps. But it was more the sense that movement is king, and the original Doom was all about movement, and it wasn't a scripted, and the pacing on it, right? It wasn't scripted, you know, guy pops out from the left, guy pops out from the right, take their headshots, oops, you got damage, run back around the hall, breathe for a second, wait, and then continue forward. It was so much about movement and how our AI worked, how the glory kills worked into that system, where the demons kind of turn into pinatas, right? Health pinatas and all that. How the levels were designed, how the levels were laid out. So basically, kind of, if I was to simplify, you've got a combat arena, you've got a connection, you got another combat arena, and so the team really, that core team that was there, really understood what Doom fans would want from the game.
Were you guys pressured to finish the game in a shorter period of time because of all the because it had been in development for so long?
I wouldn't say that we were not pressured to finish a game based on a date. There was a lot of scrutiny because people were concerned.
Right.
People, you know, ZeniMax side were very concerned about the studio, the health of the studio, the health of the team, and that Doom be the right game. That's not a date conversation. Now, no one has an infinite money tree. There's very few, like Valve's, and you know,
right. Blizzard does, but besides them,
but even Blizzard still has to.
Right,
they do amazing stuff.
Yeah,
they do give things its time, and that's really where all the questions were. How is the team going? How are things with the team? And what, you know, how are things going with the game? When do we get to see the next thing? You know, how is this part of the game going? This part of the game going? This part of the game going? Very supportive. I will give them a ton of credit for their patience with id. I know, you know, you can read stuff online that Activision, I guess, had made a bid for id years ago. And for some reason it fell through. I have no idea why. But I know companies like Activision aren't necessarily as patient as ZeniMax was.
Also, I mean, publicly traded versus privately held.
There might be a little bit of that, but even privately traded companies are, you know, again, no money tree out back. They're still going to be very sensitive to their investments.
But it's less about the quarterly earnings and just hitting.
They don't have to announce stuff. They don't have to announce stuff. But it's still there's still pressure. There's always financial pressure.
So as a studio management, as a leader on a team, do you feel like obligated to prevent crunch? Do you feel like creating a culture without without crunch is important?
This is a it's a good question, and it's one I think you talk to.
I've talked to many people.
Okay, yeah, a lot of people. I haven't heard all your podcasts, but I've heard some that were really good and I liked.
Cool.
How I think about crunch is a few things, because this is something I have to talk about and many times with different leaders.
And as management, it's like
we don't. I've never required crunch. Any studio I've been, you know, there was the EA thing like 20 years ago or 15
EA
years
spouse,
ago. EA spouse thing. That's right. Where they apparently were requiring people and saying, you know, you'd need to be here 10 to 10, and now we're working on Saturdays and working on Sundays. How I tend to think about it is, and something like work life balance is a few ways. One is don't surprise people. You cannot surprise people. People have plans. People, I've got a vacation planned that I'm going to take in 3 months, or I'm doing something with my family this weekend. You can't surprise people and say, oops, everybody's got to come in this weekend because we forgot about this milestone, or this opportunity came up and we're going to do a demo on Monday and everybody's got to stay, right? You don't want to surprise people. So much of work-life balance is setting expectations as early as possible. You also, in my experience, you want, like I said earlier, we hire for hard skills and soft skills, but you also want to hire people who are passionate about what they do. They love id, they love Doom, they love whatever component part of any game.
I'm very skeptical of the word passionate because I feel like it's used as kind of a weapon these days, but it's used to exploit people. It's like, we only want people with passion, aka we only want people who will put in all this extra time without getting paid for
it. That's not so much what I mean. What I mean, in the context of crunch, then we can talk about the word passionate later if you want to.
Yeah.
People who love what they do, you don't want to lock them out, which sounds like maybe a backwards way to think about it, but support them. Like we obviously crunched on Doom, like a lot of teams crunch. You order dinners for the team. If people are going to be on the weekend, you find ways to make sure they're supported, whether you got producers in, or if they need help, like a tester sitting by them to test their stuff before they get checked in, or they need food, right? Or you come and you bring ice cream at 10 o'clock at night, right? How many times we did play tests at 10 o'clock at night? We're playing multiplayer stuff. We're playing single player stuff.
Yeah.
Because that's the time when people
So let me ask you something. So as someone who is in a position of leadership at the studio, you say we obviously crunched on Doom. And I think that's become sort of the status quo is like any AAA game, you're going to have to crunch. But when you're coming in and you're in a position where you could potentially prevent that, is there, in your perspective, like, could you prevent that? Well, what could you do to make it so people didn't have to crunch at all?
Yeah. So, it's a hard, there's a lot of nuance.
I agree. I don't think this is black and white.
I'll give you an example of the nuance. I mean, we had a guy, one of our most senior, strongest programmers, leave at 6 o'clock every day.
Yeah.
Because that was his schedule. He had a family, he had a life. That's how he did stuff. He was also in at 7. So he was getting 3 hours of work done before anybody else was. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to ask that guy to stay after 6 when I know he's super productive. The work he does is super valuable. Mm-hmm. He's a great guy to work with. The soft skills are there. And he's getting his stuff done. That's what we're measuring, right? Mm-hmm. The cover of the box doesn't say everybody worked 80 hours for the last 6 months on this. It doesn't say that, right? That's not what we're selling. We're selling the result, the thing that's on screen, and the experience that you have in that, right? And so measuring seat time has never been something that's been a good thing, a positive thing. I've been in lots of performance reviews for various levels of individual contributor to leads, et cetera. And I've never enjoyed when, you know, say you got 3 or 4 people who kind of evaluate certain individuals, where say, oh, the guy's always here. I step back and say, okay, look, that's good. I like that as a he clearly has passion for the team. We have probably 10 people at the studio here at E3. I also consider that passionate. They're not working. You know, we're not having them work. Some of them might be doing some booth duty and everything. But they're coming because they love the space. They love the place that E3 is. They love seeing the reaction and the response. They love talking to their friends in the industry and saying, hey, look at this thing that we just did. Look at the stuff that we shut off. And it's got the arch on it. And it's super cool, right? They love being a part of that, right? That's passion too.
Sure.
And so... So that's how I think about it. There's also last thing on this topic that I'll say is, so much of leadership, one aspect of leadership is, setting an example. And I don't mean setting an example in that you need to be the first one to start crunching. That is part of it, right? If you don't ask other people to do something you're not willing to do.
Oh, yeah.
Even if you're not a coder, but if you're asking them to put in extra work, you can't do their work, yeah, but you can at least be there to support them during the extra hours that they have to put in that
if
time.
If you're leaving at 5 and they're all in the office at 2 a.m.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You don't want to be asking them to do that. It does happen.
Off. Yeah.
It does happen. I've had to do that many times. I have to go coach a basketball game, and I know people are still there, right? But oftentimes, as much as I can, I'll come back after the basketball game, right after my kids' game. Also, as a leader, you don't want to start working until 10 o'clock all the time when you're not, when you don't have a milestone, where there isn't something major, right? There's some people that get in the habit of just like, oh, I just like to work and I'm always at work and I'm at work till 10. The problem is, if you do that when you're a leader, everybody else looks around and says, oh, maybe I shouldn't be leaving.
Yeah.
And then you start burning people out before the milestones, before you really need the extra push. And so that's a bit of a challenge all leaders have, right? And it's a delicate balance. You know, it's always a challenge that we have in this industry to deal with the pressures of deadlines and dates. And like
it
I said
is,
before,
yeah,
ZeniMax was more, very supportive and more focused on the quality bar we were hitting than the specific date. Now, of course, once you get closer to a holiday or something, then, you know, the date questions start coming up more. And they did give us some extra time, but they weren't going to release us and Fallout 4 in the same window anyway.
That might
have been the smartest thing. And so we released a few months after.
For what it's worth, my perspective has long been that I think crunch is going to happen no matter what, but I think it should always be paid. I feel like any overtime hours should be paid.
Yeah, that's
accordingly
and recognized. I mean, there's also pay issues and there's recognition issues. Majority of at least the teams I work on don't have hourly employees. There's some contract employees who are hourly, but mostly the majority of the team is on salary.
Yeah, I mean, that's the difficult part. I feel like there needs to be some way to account for, like, you're on salary, but you're putting in twice the work than you're paid for.
The big thing, and I think you hit a key point, and there are things we do with bonuses. There's things we do with comp time that maybe don't go into a salary paycheck, but that do end up coming back and kind of air quotes paying back.
And get taxed extra.
Well, okay, there's that too. I don't have control of that. But the thing, though, that's important is kind of something I referred to earlier. Don't measure seat time.
Right.
If someone's getting results and getting more results, and again, maybe they're getting those results in the 40-hour week or whatever it is, right?
Sure.
Then that's what you measure and that's what you want to reward.
Mm-hmm.
I've been on teams where there's people that just say, I'm going to be here till midnight every night because that's going to prove to my lead that I'm the best.
God, yeah,
and
that's the worst.
In some cases, that person's getting 12 hours or whatever amount of productivity. And in other cases, that person tends to get 8 hours of work, but just spread out over 12 hours.
Uh-huh.
And so you don't want that. There's people you have to tell, like, bro, you got to go home.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's because they look stressed out and frazzled, and you have to measure this, right? It's a team business. I tell everybody, this is kind of a thing I just kind of started saying in the last, last year or so, that you want to have success in the games business, there's two things you got to focus on. It's people and it's people.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, that sounds pithy, but the first people is the game developers, right? The people making the game. And I would include all the people bringing the game to market with a lot of great marketing and sales and all the groups like that do that. But you want a great game, you find a great game development team. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have one or one's not available, then you need to build a great team. And the second people is obviously customer and players, If you're building something that's not what they want for various reasons, and you know, we got great feedback on Doom, one part of the game they absolutely loved and played it longer than we thought, right? Yep. As far as us looking at the analytics and the metrics of how often people were playing the game even 18 months later, right?
Uh-huh.
And in other parts of the game where they didn't play nearly as much as we thought they would.
Multiplayer, so, it feels like they're not loved as much.
Yeah, it didn't necessarily get as much playtime as we thought it would before we launched, right? But those are two things you need to worry about. Worry about your development teams, and worry about the people on the other side of the whatever it is. A free game or a pay game or whatever it is. The other side
good,
of the table.
Good perspective. So we do have to wrap things up shortly.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
I wanted to ask you one more thing. Let's end on a really positive note here. Because you guys, after all the development hell, after all the reboots, you guys came out with this game and it just blew people away. It was critically acclaimed. It was people loved it. Game of the Year awards, et cetera, et cetera. What was the like in the studio on launch day when you guys came out and the reviews are raving and people just loved it?
I will if we think about the emotion of the studio, 2013, high stress.
Yes.
Real nervousness, right? Anxiety, worried, like, okay, I hope the publisher really likes what we're showing. We like it, but, you know, you're so close to it, right? And then that went well. In 2014, we started building up the team and, you know, and all that. 2015, we were starting to show publicly. And that is, you talk about reward. Like, you can't pay people enough. You can't pay me enough to replace the reward of watching people love your game, right? Mm-hmm. It's manna from heaven. We probably lived on that high for a year after we went from QuakeCon, and that was whatever, 2015, whatever it was. And that's great, right?
Helps momentum, that's for sure.
Oh my gosh. And plus, when you're working on something that's quiet and you can't say anything, and yet you're seeing negative commentary online from jaded ex-employees. Uh-huh. Oh gosh, right? And so there was that kind of emotional surge, I guess, and feel in the studio, a better way to say that. And then we actually, before launch, we did a beta. You know, everybody does betas. We did a multiplayer beta. We made the mistake of it was a little bit buggy, not bad like some other betas I've played, but also we announced the season pass at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so we got a lot, and we made the mistake. It was PC, so it was just on Steam. We made the mistake of keeping open the forum comments, which you don't have to do for betas, free betas. And when people buy a game on Steam, as I learned through this process, you can only make comments on a game if you've proved that you bought it, right? Just through their system, you know, they'll say, yes, you can make comments, you can't leave comments. Well, in a beta, free beta,
then anyone can.
Anybody can, right? Yeah. If you turn on comments. So we turned on comments, and we did not get good feedback.
Oh, no.
It was all the negativity, all the negative feelings came back.
Yeah, I remember this. I remember people were worried about it because the multiplayer wasn't.
A lot of the drama came from, some of it came from the season pass that we announced it, and people were voicing, just like they would do with Mordor, just like they would with Battlefront 2. Like, we're voicing, we don't like loot boxes, or season pass, or whatever. And so don't tell us about a season pass. We haven't played the game yet, all this kind of stuff. And then the other thing that some people gave us feedback on that might have influenced some of the negativity was, it's a skill-based game. And if you come in there a couple days after everybody else and you're getting killed by these 12-year-old thumb ninjas, you know, it's not going to make you feel good. So there were some people that left us negative commentary on that one. But it is what it is. But anyway, to your question, that was a bit of an ebb, right? A negative kind of emotional vibe that we had. And then we launched, right? And then we came out, and everybody is like, you know, working so many hours, it's almost anticlimactic when you actually really get to launch the game. And you've gone through cert, so a lot of people kind of starting to take downtime.
Yeah.
But it's like, oh, it's finally out, you know? But you start seeing all the positive feedback. And I couple things I'll tell you. I can remember watching a guy named Draku, who's an amazing player. There's a lot of amazing players playing Doom. He was playing multiplayer, and we're watching him on Twitch, watching him just wreck. And he's talking about, I took this guy, I took this. And we were having so much fun watching him. I took a photo of, there's like 8 or 10 guys around, took a photo and sent it to him. And he was like, oh my gosh, the head team's watching. It's really kind of funny. But that kind of stuff was such a high, such an emotional high for the studio. Uh-huh. And a sigh of relief, but such an excitement, like, wait a minute, we believe in this. And wow, so does everybody else.
Yeah.
And the number of comments or podcasts like this, where I heard someone that's a well known press, whatever, long history press, people say,
just raving about it.
And people say, this game had no business being good.
Yeah.
With all the negative stuff online, culturally, about the studio previously, and then all, you know, the beta and some of the negative commentary that this game had. You hear those kind of comments, and in the next statement, people say, "But oh my gosh, I can't put it down.
This
is a different experience than I expected, and it feels so Doom, and I love it." And I'll tell you the other thing that I joined id, and the thing that kind of woke me up every day, and the thing I thought about every night that inspired me, is seeing three words in the title of an article or in a review, and that's that id is back. Or id is fucking back is how we would talk about it at the studio, right? Hopefully no kids are listening.
Yeah.
But it was just that thought that we turn this around, and again, it's that second people, right?
Yeah,
the audience, it's that they're speaking. We're not on stage saying we're awesome. It's other people saying, "Oh my gosh, this is really
good." It was
cool
to see. It is. It's always cool to see. People love a redemption story.
It's an exciting chapter in my life. I love it, and I think it was the rebuilding of it was that was 4 or 5 years I was there. Good chapter in the history of it.
Very
anyway,
cool.
We got to wrap up.
Where can people find you, Garrett?
At Garetti on Twitter, I guess.
Cool.
I don't say much interesting there.
No,
you might see some dad stuff on there.
Yeah, some dad stuff. Nice. Talking about your basketball coach.
There you go. All that kind of stuff.
Thank you so much, Garrett. Really appreciate it.
Great meeting you.
Kotaku Split Screen is an official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Kirk Hamilton and me, Jason Schreier. Kirk edits and mixes the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. We're a part of the Fusion Podcast Network, where Mandana Mufidi is executive producer of audio. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR Now, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts. And we hope you leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen or email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.